Welcome. It's 10 minutes past 1. The House Judiciary Committee is in session. In attendance are Representative Lynn, Representative Gruenberg, Representative Coghill, Representative Ramirez, Representative Dahlstrom's Things, with the representative soon to follow, Representative Holmes, and Representative Gatto. The full committee is here. Mm-hmm. Could be death penalty day if we were prepared. Darn it. We are going to take up a number of bills today. Our friend Joyce Anderson is here in the audience. We can't wait to see you. First, we're going to take up House Bill 108 with Jane Pearson to guide us through final pertinent pieces of House Bill 108. Jane, good afternoon. The floor is yours.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Jay Ramirez. And before you, you should have Amendment P2 to House Bill 108, Version P. And this amendment does three things. The first part of the amendment, page 2, lines 27 through 29, conforms the language of the internet publication with newspaper publication. Page 4, line 21, cures the problem that the deed of trust could have a different cure time than the statute. And on page 5, lines 15 through 21, describes information on curing the default that must be included in the original notice of default. And those are the changes that we propose in House Bill 108. And online should be a number of people who can testify.
Thank you. Are there questions for Jane Pearson? Excellent. So we want to first go to Robert Schmidt, Representative Gruenberg.
Yes. Since I think the main thing we're going to be discussing, and we need to have it before us, is your amendment. And if you offer your amendment, I'll object for discussion so that they can technically give testimony on the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Gruenberg. All right, so we have Mr. Schmidt standing by. Well, let's go to the P version of House Bill 108. I'm going to move amendment number 1.
And I'll object for discussion only.
Thank you for the assistance. Representative Gruenberg objects. Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Relative to amendment number 1 that is intended to harmonize the written publication with the internet publication, I'm okay with it as long as the committee clarifies that when they say that it is the intention that the internet publication and the written publication be coextensive, and that internet publication is not required every day. And the reason for that clarification is because the written publication is only once a week for 4 weeks. That costs about $500 to achieve. If you publish in the Anchorage Daily News, if you get a print ad, you only get an online ad for 2 days. If you had to publish for 4 weeks continuously, that would greatly increase the cost of publication. So I'd like to clarify that the understanding with the First Amendment is to harmonize print and online publication. Is this the appropriate time for me to comment on the change regarding the 2-day rule?
Yes, it would be.
All right. I apologize to the committee, and I hope that I'm not viewed as being excessively obstructionist, but I deal with this law almost every day, and I want to make sure that we get it right. I strongly support this bill in total, and I think it makes many favorable changes. But there is one, I think, unintended issue here with the 2-day rule, and that is that the 2-day rule, as it is worded now, is mandatory. Under the current scheme, you can cure a default and stop a foreclosure by paying, curing the loan anytime before the sale, whether it's 5 minutes or 5 days. And the current law also includes what's called a 3-strike rule. If you've been in foreclosure twice before, on the third strike, the bank can elect to refuse a cure and proceed with the foreclosure sale. I would propose, language as it is going to be amended states that the notice of default must include the 2-day language, and that the 2-day language must include a waiver of the 3-strikes rule. Specifically, I propose that Section 4 of the bill, which is on page 4, line 17, be amended so that it says, and if the beneficiary of the trust deed so elects, 9, a statement described, etc. That would leave it at the discretion of the beneficiary, typically a bank, to decide whether or not they want to apply the two-day rule. And then on this amendment, looking then at Section 6 of the bill, which is page 5, line 12, adding language that says, if the beneficiary so elects, a statement required by B9 of this section may state, changing must to may. That way, it would be at the discretion of the bank whether or not they want to cut off the borrower's right to cure defaults to 2 days out, and also make it optional to the beneficiary whether or not they want to waive the protections of the three-day rule. And I thank the committee again for its time and for hearing me out on this.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schmidt, through the chair, this is Max Grunberg. You were, as often is the case, going faster than my brain could keep up on the language you want. Would you please go back very carefully? You're suggesting several amendments to the amendment with the agreement of the chair. I'd like Mr. Schmidt to carefully go back and tell us the exact wording he wants put in and where. Very slowly.
Yes, Representative Grunberg. Looking at version P of the bill on page 4.
Go ahead.
On line 17.
Yeah.
You'll see the word and 9.
Right, yes.
I propose changing it to and, comma, if the beneficiary under the trust deed so elects, comma,
just
9, a statement, striking out the. That is the first change that I propose.
Just a second here. Just a second. And I think it has to go after the 9, be comma, if the beneficiary so elects, comma. Then it would state, the 9 would say, and 9, if the beneficiary so elects, the statement described in E of this section describing conditions for curing the default, is that what you want to say?
That is correct.
Okay. Go ahead.
Now, turning to page 5 of draft P of the bill, line 12.
Okay.
I think the simplest change would be striking the word the and placing a statement, then striking required and changing it to allowed. A statement allowed by B9 of this section, then strike must and put in the word may.
Okay, anything else?
That is all.
Now, let me, if I may inquire for a moment, Mr. Chair. Are these part of the same amendment? They're both to make it discretionary?
It is my intention that with these changes is to make it discretionary on the part of the beneficiary whether they want to cut off the borrower's right to stop the foreclosure to curing 2 days out.
I understand now. Those look like they're different in subject matter from the amendment that has been offered. I think that it'd have to be offered as a separate amendment. Was there anything else that you're suggesting in the bill, sir?
I would suggest in my email conversations with Mr. Routh's office and also emails that I sent to Ms. Pearson and I believe to other members of the committee, that internet publication and print publication should be harmonized. Looking at the Amendment 2 that is before us, I would suggest that the amendment would be more effective if instead of the language that is there, that it say publication of the notice.
What line are you on?
I'm on line 5 of the amendment 2.
That's P.2.
P.2, that is correct.
Please go ahead.
Okay, and give me just a second here. I'm thinking on my feet. Publication of the notice must occur 4 times, once a week, for 4 successive weeks.
Is that in place of the remainder of lines 5, 6, and 7?
Excuse me, Mr. Grunberg. I just want to remind you that's not my amendment. What you're getting are some suggestions from Mr. Schmidt to my amendment.
No, I understand.
To the chairman's amendment.
No, I understand. I just want to know what he's saying so we can write this down. And I'm just putting Schmidt by it. I'm not saying that we've adopted it at all.
Thank you for that courtesy, Representative Grunberg. Thank
you. And are you talking about it would be for the remainder of lines 5, 6, and 7?
Yes. I'm the language that is proposed in the amendment, I think, is ambiguous as to whether the internet ad must occur daily, which is different than the requirement for the print ad. I think the bill would be stronger if it were clear that the internet ad requirement was coextensive with the print ad, i.e., once a week for 4 successive weeks.
So the language, once again, would you give that to me? And I appreciate your courtesy and letting me. I want the record to be clear on this. Mr.
Okay.
Schmidt, after the word notice must, what is, you're striking the rest of lines 5, 6, and 7, and what are you going to say?
Must continue 4 times, once a week, or 4 successive weeks. And I am borrowing that language from the print ad section, which is found on page 2 of version P at line 2.
Page 4, line 2, you said?
Page 2, line 2.
I see. Okay. I see. Okay. Okay. Anything else, sir?
No, and thank you very much for hearing me out on this.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Are there any other questions for Mr. Schmidt? Thank you for joining us today, Mr. Schmidt. Can we now go to Mr. Routh, please?
Hi, Mr. Chairman, Stephen Routh, Routh Crabtree. As one of the drafters of some of this language, I'm pleased to address the committee. I'm a bit flabbergasted that some of these changes that we just heard would be suggested, since the language in the amendment is largely the language suggested by Mr. Schmidt. One of the issues of the internet publication, if it was mandated that it occur only once a week for 4 weeks, we've just destroyed the value of the internet and using that for its transparency that it provides to the process, because nobody will do that. The papers won't do that. I called the newspapers after Mr. Smith sent his email, which he had not talked to them, but I talked to the Daily News and to the Journal of Commerce, and they all publish these ads. They'll publish them for free. They start when the print ad starts, and they basically never go off. They stay on Journal of Commerce for 9 months, they were finding some. And that's what you want in this. You want an open, transparent process. You don't want it closed and hidden. And in Mr. Schmidt's email, when he suggests that the process should be reserved for elitists and niche players and not open to the public and transparent because people generally are not smart enough to participate, I am literally dumbfounded by that kind of comment. So I think the language is perfectly clear. The ad should start when the print ad begins, as Mr. Schmidt had suggested and resulted in this change, and should continue every day during the course of the 4-week publication, just as it states in the amendment. Then if I could address the 2-day rule, once again, this is language suggested by Mr. Schmidt and then drafted by the legislative drafting. The The 2 days should not be a mandatory thing. It's going to be exercised with discretion by the banks. No bank's going to turn away money nowadays, but it helps borrowers in the sense that there's last-minute cures. It gives options short of litigation. Mr. Schmidt's firm litigates these things, and we choose not to. We'd rather solve it by legislation to make the process clear. Oregon has a 10-day requirement, far more foreclosures than Alaska, and has never had a challenge that I recall hearing about to the fact that it should be optional or 10 days is too much. This is just a 2-day period out of a process that's taking 6 months, so that we don't have a specter of litigation and confusion at the last minute. I believe that's that addresses the points, and I'd certainly be open for questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Routh? I don't see any questions here from the committee. Committee members, we do have available Richard Ohlstrom is here, is available by phone, speaking for himself, as is Mary Breedsley from the Attorney General's office, and Glenn Turner is also available from Alaska Housing. Do members have any questions for any of these folks? We thank everybody for your testimony. We have before us amendment number one. Representative Gruenberg, you objected to amendment number one. Do you wish to offer an amendment to the amendment?
First of all, I'm going to remove my objection. Secondly, I will not offer an amendment.
Thank you.
I agree with Mr. Roth.
Thank you. So so we have amendment number one before us. The objection has been removed. Seeing no objection, amendment number one passes. We're back to the bill before us as it was drafted. Are there any additional amendments or any committee discussion on House Bill 108? I see no more discussion around the table. The chair would look for a motion. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the CS for House Bill number 108, version P, with any attached physical note and individual recommendations.
Thank you. Seeing no objection, House Bill 108, Judiciary, version P as in Peter, moves from committee. Take a brief at ease. We're back on the record. We are delighted to have before us our good friend Reneva Moss from Representative Coghill's office and Joyce Anderson, the ethics czar. We have before the committee today the CS for House Bill 193, the State Affairs version, version T as in Thomas. No, I think it's already been moved, and we will have available to the members Dan Wayne with legal. What does legal mean? Ledge legal. Okay, and
as opposed to illegal.
Yeah.
No, illegal is a sick bird.
All right. You know, Joyce.
Mr. Chairman, we should always have a camera in here.
You know, Joyce, we behave one way when the camera's in the room, and another way when it's not, which sometimes goes to the subject matter. Today we are happy to have some corrections to the ethics bill before us. Reneva, are you going to take us through the bill? And then Joyce, if you'll let us know at the appropriate time what your role is in being before us, we're happy to have you. We'd like when you're here.
For the record, Reneva Moss, staff to Representative Coghill. The CS that you have before you had one change in state affairs, and that was Section 1. Section 1 takes the word gratuity and changes it to the word gift. This makes the ethics section of Title 24 consistent. And then it also clarified a concern that I can't remember if it was Representative Gruenberg or Representative Seaton. He wanted to clarify that mailing lists, email lists, et cetera, for campaigns and for legislative offices were interchangeable, so that you could use your legislative email list for your campaign and you could use your campaign list for your legislative office. And then as we get into Section 2, we start addressing some of the concerns that have been part of discussion with legislators and the Ethics Committee for a couple of years. Section 2, what we're trying to do here is draw a bright line for legislators and staff in assisting constituents when they come to a legislative office for assistance in a problem they've encountered with a state agency. And the new language, with the help of the administrative hearing officer, has also, administrative hearing judge, also put in language that protects legislators or their staff from accidental encounters with people involved in an administrative hearing, unintentional. One example would be a constituent comes to you and asks for your assistance. You contact the office, let's say it's a workers' comp office. They have not told you that it is at an administrative hearing level. So by contacting them, you are actually doing something that is unethical. This would clear you of any wrongdoings. Section 3 is allowing a person to give a legislator or a legislative staffer a gift of more than $250 when it involves a charitable event, like a charitable ticket or a gift that was won at a charitable event. It can go over the $250, but in Section 5, it requires you to report that overage. In Section 4, this says that if it's a lobbyist, it cannot be more than $250, and that is a lobbyist, an immediate family member of a lobbyist, or someone who is acting on behalf of a lobbyist. Section 5, again, is the reporting requirement for gifts over $250. Section 7 provides for public members of the Ethics Committee to receive $150 compensation per day when they are attending Ethics Committee meetings.
Did you cover Section 6?
I was just told I missed it. Okay, Section 6 basically just says that any information that is confidential and protected under state or federal law is not required to be reported, and it remains confidential. And that puts me at Section 8. And what this does is it allows an alternate, whether it be public or legislative alternate, who is participating in an ethics committee meeting, making a decision because of a conflict with another member, they are to participate in that meeting through its entire duration, until the proceeding ends in a decision of some kind. And then Section 9 is where we come into the definitions, and I can read those if you would like, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, just on that one point on Section 8, it also adds a public alternate.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, that is true. It does provide for the legislature already has an alternate for each body, and this provides an alternate for the public sector members. Mr. Chairman, would you like me to read the definitions?
No. Do you feel compelled to?
No, Mr. Chairman, I don't.
Okay.
We call it an irresistible impulse in criminal law. It's a type of insanity.
Representative Grunberg, you suffer from many irresistible impulses.
Mr. Chair, if I could just say a couple words.
Yes, ma'am.
My name is Joyce Anderson. I'm the administrator for the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. Most of the recommendations in the bill were discussed at the Legislative Ethics Committee meeting on February 24th, of which Representative Coghill is a member, and were moved forward. There have been a couple that were added in here based on previous discussion, the administrative hearing one, and then the definitions were the two areas that were not discussed at the Ethics Committee meeting, but they have been definitely, as Ryan Neva have said, a discussion item. So they're good that they're in here. The one regarding not disclosing if it's prohibited by state law or federal law basically has to do more with a question that had come up about a medical issue, whether you're providing medical services, and does that under HIPAA then prohibit you from disclosing that you have a financial relationship with an individual over a long term? And so this would cover that type of a situation. And so that was basically a question that had come to light from someone who had asked the Ethics Committee for an advisory opinion. So that's definitely in there. I would like to say, under the definition section, I know I had a discussion with Representative Coghill earlier, and I both of us had talked about putting this on record. Under the definition of constituent, which means a person to whom a legislator owes a duty of representation under the Constitution of the State of Alaska, is a very, very broad definition. And the Ethics Committee recently issued a complaint decision regarding a legislator who they found in violation sending a newsletter to individuals who were not within the legislator's constituent district, and it had to do with a campaign issue. And so I wanted to put on the record that even though this definition of constituent is very broad, there are other sections in the statute that would cover this particular situation, such as stating that you cannot do anything that's in regard to campaigning, which would have been looked at it that way. At least that's the way the Ethics Committee looked at it. There's also another section in the statute that talks about private benefit. So I think those two particular sections, of which we also have a definition of private benefit now, fall into that. So that would cover those particular areas. I know that when I sent out the bill to all the Ethics Committee members for review, two of them responded that they were concerned about the definition of constituent, and I responded back to them letting them know that I felt these other sections covered their concern about making the definition so broad.
Representative Holmes has a question, and then Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on that definition of constituent, you said it's pretty broad. There's a lot of things we do in this building directly to help our constituents, and then there are other things sometimes we do to help people who may not actually live in our district or may not be registered in our district. Would those people be covered? Would we be allowed to continue to provide services to people who don't strictly live in our district under the bill right now?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. On page 9, it says, public members shall receive $150 a day while attending meetings. And a little further down on page 9, shall appoint an alternate member for each regular meeting. And I think we're going to come up with, if an alternate member is there, are they entitled to the $150?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, that would only be if they are participating in an official capacity.
May I follow up on that question, please?
Representative Greenberg.
How about if you have somebody come because a person may not be able to participate in one of a number of issues on the agenda, and they have to sit there for the whole day, and they may or may not ultimately be called? I would assume they would be entitled to be paid for that, would they not?
Through the chair, Representative Greenberg, if you look on page 10, it says on line 9 that they shall participate for the duration of that meeting. So if someone is going to be sitting in as an alternate, they need to be there for the entire meeting.
Even if they're not called upon?
Through the chair, Representative Gruber, they're there as in their official capacity because the regular member was unable to attend, and so they're there in that person's place.
And that's not the hypo.
Okay.
But the hypo I'm giving is that somebody who's a regular member may not be able to vote on a certain issue, one of 10 items on the agenda, and you call upon the alternate to be there in case that person is unable to participate on that one issue. And then that alternate would just come and vote on that one issue, but they'd have to be there to be prepared to do that. I assume then they would get their compensation, wouldn't they, for the day?
Through the chair, Mr. Greenberg, that scenario would not be allowed. Based on the language on line 9, they would have to be there for the duration of the meeting. They would not be able to come in and sit in for a particular item because the person that was at the meeting had to step out for a minute or whatever. That's the way the language was drafted.
Well, then if I may, Madam Chair.
Yes.
We hadn't thought of this before, but it would seem to me that one of the reasons for having an alternate would be if somebody were disqualified or something, that alternate should be able to sit in, and the law should be drafted to allow that to occur and to compensate that person to be there.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say through the chair, if both of them are there on an official capacity, then both of them would receive the compensation.
That's what I want to accomplish. It sounded like Ms. Anderson didn't think it was drafted to do that, and if it's not, I'll offer another amendment, conceptual amendment, to make sure that can occur if everybody's agreeable. Because I don't want somebody to be called upon to be there and actually maybe have to participate. I want them to be able to participate even if it's on only on one issue, and I want them to be compensated if they're asked to be there. Whether or not they have to vote or not, that's not fair otherwise.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, there is another part of the statute. You mentioned the word if there's a conflict. There is another part of the statute under AS 2460-130, which is the makeup of the Ethics Committee, that says if a legislator or a public member has a conflict, they need to recuse themselves. That would happen in a complaint decision, or it could happen in an advisory opinion. Let's say they're requesting the advisory opinion. That would be covered under another part of the section, that they're there to participate for that particular item because the other person has a conflict. But my understanding is the way this was drafted and the discussion that we had at the Ethics Committee meeting, if Representative Coghill agrees with me, I'd like to hear his comments, because this was my understanding, is that it wasn't to allow for a person to be at the meeting and step out for a few minutes and have somebody come in and sit in and then vote on that issue, as what happens with you at committee meetings, you know, if you have to step out for a minute. It would operate similar to the way your committee meetings are, but if they need to be recused because of a conflict, or they requested an advisory opinion, or they're the subject of the complaint, that is covered where they would sit in on that particular point. Am I correct in that?
I'm sorry.
Representative Gatto, and then...
Just to answer the question, the anticipation was, first of all, there was a quorum issue, one of the reasons why you'd have an alternate. And then if somebody was conflicted out, in which case it was anticipated that they would miss the entire meeting, and then the alternate would take place of that entire meeting. And that was what the discussion was. And so that's what has been proposed here.
May I, on that point, please?
On that point, Representative Groomer.
I can understand, but having sat on that committee, and I think there are other people who've been in this situation, it may very well happen that an alternate, and we're talking about now putting public alternates on, where these are really what we're talking about.
That's what we're dealing with.
That there may come a reason why a person, a public member, and we have like three public members, and this alternate would be just one alternate, so it could happen with any one of those three. And in fact, on issue number one, one person might be disqualified. On issue number two, another person might be disqualified. And so it would seem to me that the alternate, if the alternate were there, would be able to sit in place of one person on one issue, one person on another, so that the, as much as possible, the committee would have a full complement of people there. And number one, I'd like to be sure the law is drafted to permit that. And number two, if the alternate is there for that purpose, whether or not they're ultimately called, if they're there because they might be called, that person deserves the compensation. That only seems fair.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I think what Joyce was missing was the fact that they may not all be in the room at the same time. There may be three issues on the agenda, and one or two members of the public portion of the board would have to leave the room for the discussion on item number two. Mm-hmm. But they're all there in an official capacity as public members of the Ethics Committee, then all of them would be compensated.
Through the chair, is that clear from the way this thing is drafted?
To me, it is, through the chair.
And number two, is there anything in the way this bill or the law is drafted to prohibit, under that circumstance, an alternate from just voting on the one issue that there's a conflict on? You have to speak.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, to answer your question, it's covering all of the scenarios that you have pointed out.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was curious. I just want to talk about public members, because in the language it says, unless for any reason unable to participate, then the public member will participate for the duration of the meeting. So at the very beginning of the meeting, the public member would know, is not able to participate, and the alternate would be the participant. So now the question.
Yeah, I think that's a real
Representative
point.
Grunberg.
No.
Representative Grunberg, please let Representative Gatto just finish his thought, please.
I
promise.
I apologize for the record.
So I've lost track. there are two people now. The regular public member and the alternate public member. The regular public member cannot be there for conflict of interest in item 17. But he's there. He's there. He's on time. Does he simply not serve on the meeting at the meeting, but the alternate serves, and therefore the public member actually need not attend the meeting in the first place because he's conflicted out on one item?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I'll answer your question after I give you just a brief history of what happened here or why this is being proposed, is that legislators have alternate members, so when they can't attend, the alternate sits in. We have had some concerns where the public members do not have an alternate member, and for some reason, let's say two public members are unable to attend the meeting because they have a conflict with their work schedule, or something came up the day before or whatever. And we didn't have a person that would be able to sit in for that particular reason. And if we don't have three public members, we don't have a quorum. So let's say one got hung up in Nome because of weather. Now we don't have a meeting. So the intent was to have it for any reason, meaning that they just couldn't make it. So that answers part of your question. If I think there's several things we're looking at here. We're looking at a meeting and we're looking at a proceeding. A proceeding has to do with a complaint. If a public member needs to recuse themselves from a complaint, which is really what brought this to light, is that recently we had to have two public members who recused themselves from an issue. We felt we needed a public member. And so when there's a proceeding, that person would sit through the proceeding. There may be three meetings that deal with that complaint proceeding. They would then sit through all three of those meetings because they started with the issue and they have to finish the issue. So they know what's going on from beginning to end. If it's an open meeting and there's a conflict within an issue, let's say an advisory opinion, then the public member, the alternate would come in and sit in for that particular issue only, or the other member would be there. Okay. Am I answering your question or making it more confusing? I'm sorry.
More confusing, but I do have a follow-up. And that is for the purpose of legislators. Representative Coghill is driving down from Fairbanks. It's a snowstorm, slow down. Representative Gatto shows up at the meeting. We convene the meeting. He shows up 20 minutes later. It says for the duration of the meeting. So he's out, I'm in. Is that the way it's written?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, that's the way I would read it.
Okay. And as far as compensation, I think that doesn't change then, does it? Mm-hmm. He comes down. He's certainly invested quite a bit of time already, and he would not be denied an interim per diem for spending that time. Just want to know that we're all on the same page on what is the likely outcome of any scenario that we might be presented with. And so I think the one for the legislators is easy. I just wanted to then go back, assuming that you're in agreement that I'm in, he's out, as long as we didn't wait for him to come. If we waited, then that's not a relevant question. But if it convened, then that's what would happen.
That is my understanding, Representative Gatto.
Now, second question is, it's now the next meeting, and we're continuing with the subject of the previous meeting. Now what happens?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, we only have that language in for a complaint proceeding. And that's because for a complaint proceeding, you need to have consistency from meeting to meeting so that you are aware of the information from the first meeting to the second meeting. The way this is written, it does not apply to a full committee meeting.
Okay. So for some other reason, it would only be involving a complaint. Okay, I got that part. Then go back to the public member. Same sort of situation. I know I have a conflict on item 17. I'm a public member. She's a public member. She knows she has to be there to cover item 17. Do I simply not start the meeting as the public member, and instead she does? Or do I start the meeting, she preempts me on item 17, and it gets more confusing then? What is this? How does the scenario play?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, the only way that I can foresee that there would be a conflict, it would be regarding an advisory opinion, which is definitely defined out in statute that you would have a conflict under certain conditions. So if there was an advisory opinion, the way I'm reading this and the way I would think it would be interpreted based on our discussion at our last committee meeting would be that you would sit in on the meeting, and when item 17 came up, you would you know, the chair would put on the record that you have a conflict and that your alternate member is now sitting in for the discussion regarding item 17 and including the vote on item 17, you would come back into the meeting after for item 18.
And would she be entitled to per diem?
Yes, she would.
That's what I thought. Thank you.
I would hope so. Representative Grunberg, do you have a question or has it been answered?
I believe it does because the practice has been, and I'm thinking when I was on the committee. Okay, thanks. When I was there, there was an issue that I brought up asking for an advisory opinion. And since I was the legislator requesting the opinion, I had to step out, and it had to do with the addresses on your literature. And Les Guerra sat in for me, thank you, on that particular subject, and then when that was over, I took back my seat. And I assume that that is the intent of all this language. Am I right?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, yes.
Thank you.
Very good. Can you tell me about Section 6? I don't get it.
Yeah.
I've read it 10 times, and is there a cloaked meaning? I get the second half. I don't get the first half. It seems to be without.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure there's a half to this. It just says that if there is a disclosure that you're required to make under the state ethics law that is protected under other state laws or federal laws, you do not have to disclose that information.
Okay. What is that? What is that, Representative Dahlstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my questions are in line with you. So you mentioned certain health care workers. I'm assuming that's physicians or PAs that would have patients that come to them. Can you give us another example or two?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, let's say an occupational therapist, for instance, who has a client who is either a under the definition of the statute, a legislative employee, a public official, a lobbyist, any of those individuals, and they have an ongoing relationship with that individual, such as they're providing services that end up to be thousands of dollars, that in essence becomes under the definition of substantial financial relationship. And that means if you have a substantial financial relationship with one of these individuals who is a client, you, under the way that current law is written, you would need to disclose that. And so a question came to the Ethics Committee, well, what about specifically the medical field? Maybe there are others, but the medical field is the one that came to the committee. And so if there is a law such as HIPAA or whatever that would prevent you, the way this is set up is that you would send something to the committee telling you why you don't need to disclose this. The committee may review the justification, you know, to determine whether it's sufficient so you're not just putting something in there, you're mentioning HIPAA or whatever it happens to be, and then you don't need to disclose that. And those disclosures are public. And so there's no reason for you to disclose that because it's prohibited by either a federal or state law.
Follow up, and then Representative Gocko.
Follow up. So would occupations such as a contractor or even a proprietor of a hotel who maybe bids with, you know, businesses for, with companies for repeat business, would they be included in this? Because obviously if that information that they used for bidding purposes got out, that could be very detrimental.
Okay, through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, I think what you're leading to is the APOC financial disclosure. This has nothing to do with the financial disclosure. It strictly has to do with a close economic association, which is required only on the legislative ethics part. And so this does not cover anything to do with your financial disclosure, which is, I think, what you were referring to.
Okay.
Representative Coghill?
The issue came up because somebody was asking about a dollar amount. Mm-hmm. And once it gets over a dollar amount, the question became they had an ethical problem with another law. Mm-hmm. And those laws became in tension. So the debate in the Ethics Committee was how do you put a dollar amount that could get there, and you just couldn't get there.
Yeah.
And so that's why we had to devise this language that said if there's another law in tension with this law, then such as a federal privacy act of some kind, then that would trump this law, basically, is what it amounts to.
And through the chair, if I could have one more comment, I understand that APOC has also looked at this particular language, and it's something they may be looking at as well if that's what you're concerned with.
Okay, thank you.
And I guess my question, on Section 6, why I look at it in two pieces, is that I understand the pardon me for seeing it in halves. I understand that the person may refrain from making a disclosure that violates the U.S. Constitution or Constitution of the State of Alaska. But the part I'm trying to understand is what the person is doing and what the committee is doing. A person who refrains from making a disclosure under this subsection shall provide the committee with justification in writing. That's one act. And then the committee may review the written justification to determine whether it is sufficient, is the corresponding action, I guess. And I wanted to see whether we're satisfied with the clarity because it states a premise that a person can't violate the U.S. Constitution or the state constitution, and then it says the person has to provide justification for that, and then that the committee has to decide whether that's sufficient. So that was the manner in which I saw that, and so I was hopeful that you could give me some examples of that and what the person is writing about and what the committee is deciding.
Through the chair, Representative Ramos, or you are, excuse me, you are the chair. Sorry about that. I guess I refer back to the example that Representative Coghill was referring to, and I'll make it generic.
I didn't get that example. I'm sorry. Okay. I wasn't in the room at the time, so I didn't.
We had an individual who was in the, I will say, the healthcare field.
Okay.
And was asking whether she needed to file a close economic association because she had a, let's just say, an ongoing relationship with this client to provide services in the medical area.
Okay.
Which then became, as Representative Coghill was saying, we were looking at dollar amounts, but in essence would have become a substantial financial relationship. And so she wanted to know if she needed to disclose that, but she was concerned about HIPAA and the requirements for HIPAA, which are confidentiality of patient-client. And so the example would be then is that she would submit a letter to the Ethics Committee saying, you know, here is my occupation. I have a client who is a lobbyist, and it's an ongoing relationship to provide these types of services. Under HIPAA, I believe that I do not have to disclose this particular close economic association, which then becomes a public record. And so the Ethics Committee would look at it and they would say, well, yes, HIPAA does have a patient-client relationship, or excuse me, a confidentiality relationship. And so then there would not be a disclosure. And I think the reason they have in there is that the committee may review is so that they can, so that the committee has the option to take a look to see whether it actually is a confidentiality issue under state or federal law. So I hope that answers your question.
It does not.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, ma'am.
The way this is written, the person is not required to do this automatically, only if they're requested to by the Ethics Committee. So if the Ethics Committee wants more information about why the information was not disclosed, they could ask that person. It's not an automatic process.
However, at the request of the committee or a person authorized to act on behalf of the committee, a person who refrains from making a disclosure, I mean, maybe it's not a big deal, but I don't understand how it's written. However, so a person doesn't have to, a person may refrain from making a disclosure. And then, however, at the request of the committee or a person authorized to act on behalf of the committee, a person who refrains from making a disclosure,
that's a staff person.
Beg your pardon, Representative Grunberg?
I think they're talking about staff. Isn't that right?
Or the chair.
Who's the person?
The person, it would be the staff person. The person authorized to act on behalf of the committee by statute is staff. It would be the administrator.
So the person refraining from making a disclosure is who?
Yourself,
right.
Legislator.
Right. That's what I thought.
Legislative employee.
So a person may refrain from making a disclosure. However, at the request of the committee or a person authorized to act on the behalf of the committee, a person, so what's the committee doing? The committee is making a request. I already chose to refrain. I don't understand where you're creating an action if I already chose to refrain. I mean, if I refrain, how do you know whether to ask me? I mean, I don't mean to get tangled up in this, but I just don't understand how Section 6 is written. It's a person may refrain, so if I choose to refrain, how will you know that I did anything? How can the committee compel me to ask something if I didn't disclose it in the first place? I mean, it seems to omit the act of disclosure in the first place to give the committee to recognize that I'm choosing to not disclose it so that the committee can decide whether I should have to write a letter of justification. I think that's where I'm wrapped up in, is it seems to be very inartfully drafted, I think is what I'm trying to convey.
Well, I have a suggestion.
Yes, ma'am.
Sir, we could say on line 3 instead of, well, let me read it. It says, however, at the request of the committee or a person authorized to act on behalf of the committee, a person who is required to make a disclosure under this section shall provide the committee with justification in writing. I'd have to add some language there. I wasn't thinking that far ahead. But we, instead of saying who refrains from making a disclosure, we need to say who is required to make a disclosure, because they're actually required to make a disclosure and they're asking the committee not to make that disclosure.
Representative Cogger?
If I might just ask a process question here. This particular section, it seems to me there's already a general prohibition. So either there's going to be a complaint-driven or request-driven on this one, so that there's already a general requirement that the close economic relationship can only be under so much amount. So help us wander through this, because that may help me understand it, or it may help us fix it. But maybe the general requirements of a close economic relationship generally, and if you go beyond a certain amount or have a close economic relationship that becomes unethical, what is that limit, so that if somebody either requests to know or somebody complains against, help me understand that that process.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, the process for filing a close economic association is a financial relationship between a legislator, a legislative employee, and either one of those, and either another legislator, a legislative employee, a lobbyist, or a public official. That's defined, I think, in 3950, which is not just elected officials, but other public officials as well. And that's a financial relationship that you would have with that individual. Let's say that you own a business and your business partner is another legislator. That would require you to file a close economic association. That is not something that would fall under this particular statute, because it's not confidential under the Constitution of the State of Alaska or other state or federal law.
Joyce, I'm a layperson, so I look through lay law through the lens of a layperson. I just want to say that if you choose, and I will offer a conceptual amendment on this point, that if you choose to refrain, that you have to say you're refraining. That's all I want to get to is that, and then it could trigger the committee deciding whether or not you should have to offer a written. But right now it seems to omit the, is that right? I mean, kind mm-hmm. of, I don't mean to be inartful, so perhaps it, so perhaps at the time somebody can help me to articulate
right.
that better. So that's my question about Section 6. I get it now, so I don't want to get wrapped around it. Do you have a question, or is it?
Oh, no, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to say that it seemed like that was the policy call that we were setting up, okay. And I agree with you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Groomberg.
I think that what you're saying is that basically to trigger the protection, I'm going to say a constitutional protection, that you should have to let the committee know
yes.
that you do have a constitutionally protected private relationship with somebody.
Right.
And then if the committee wanted to proceed, they would say, please disclose it.
Yes.
And I think you can do that conceptually. But I would like to add one thing, if I could, with a question.
Sure.
I think there should be something in here, possibly, and I hadn't really looked at it in these terms before, in the other committee, that would keep that request and the order of the committee or the staff confidential if they determined you did have a confidential right, that it wouldn't be disclosed. The exchange of correspondence would not become public documents unless it was determined that there was no right of privacy or a limited right of privacy. So if you're going to make that amendment, I would appreciate it if you could put that in there or something.
You know, Representative Grunberg, I trust you enough to offer the amendment for me that will incorporate that at the appropriate time. Is there any other discussion on the bill itself? Okay. So what I'd like to do is to move to amendments. I'm going to have an amendment to offer in a moment. Do you want to?
Why don't we take that one first?
All right. Which one?
The one we just talked about.
Okay. Representative Grunberg, would you move conceptual amendment number one, please?
Yes, and nothing's in writing here, and I don't know how you want to handle because this is...
Chairman, I'd like to make a suggestion on page 8, line 30. A person may request to refrain from making...
That might fix it right there, huh?
May request. Maybe should we say make a file a written request? I think it should be in writing. But Mr. Anderson, through the chair, Ms. Anderson, shouldn't that be in writing?
Well, it does say that later on line 4, on the next page. So I think it's covered.
But that's only if you go to the second step.
Yeah, that's if you're justifying it. I think what we really want is a written request to refrain.
So I'm going to say, if I could, so the first part of the amendment would be, and this is conceptual, number one, may submit a written request to refrain from making blah, blah, blah. And then, as the second part of that, and I'm not sure where this would go.
And you're deleting the word may, is that right?
No.
No, it's no, I think person. It has to be shall. I think that was your intention.
No, but you don't want to say shall there.
You want to say shall.
It would be...
Oh.
You don't.
Oh yeah.
Because that it's only it that's got to be made. Okay, and then the second part of it would be something conceptual. Well, I'm going to make that as the first one. Then we'll do the other.
I was going to suggest that. Okay.
All right. So, what's the conceptual amendment, please, Representative Grunberg?
Line 30, page 8, between may and refrain, add the following phrase conceptually. Submit a written request to.
All right, that's conceptual amendment number one. Is there any objection? I see none. Conceptual amendment number one passes. Representative Grunberg.
And then, and I'm not sure where this would go, maybe folks can help. I want to say that this correspondence shall not be considered a public document and disclosable unless the court, or not court, the committee, finds in the committee or the staff determines that it is disclosable, except to the extent that they say it must be disclosed, that there's no right of privacy.
And I'll object to conceptual amendment number two, Representative Cockle.
The question to the executive director, is it generally that a request for an opinion or whatever is confidential, or is it generally open, or how do you handle correspondence coming your way? Do we have to specifically identify this as confidential?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, I would say that it's not necessary because correspondence that comes into the ethics office is confidential between the person making the request and the committee providing that answer. We do not release that information.
Oh, may I inquire, Representative? Then you don't think what I'm saying is necessary?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay.
You want to withdraw conceptual amendment number two? Conceptual number two has been Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you. And Ms. Anderson, thanks for helping us with our understanding of this. I don't know what year the Ethics Committee was developed, and I'm sure that it, like every other committee, has, you know, evolved and gotten better each year. Do the members of the Ethics Committee sign confidentiality paperwork about the things that they hear and documents that they might review, that they are required to basically carry that information to the grave with them? Do they take a different oath than we take when we're sworn in? I mean, because, and I ask with the thought in mind that many of the things that potentially, and I don't know because I've never been called before the Ethics Committee, I hope I never am, just, and you know, this could be inaccurate, but I think a lot of our perception is that we're, if we're called before the Ethics Committee, it's because we've done something wrong. So, but also, I would want to know that anything that was stated there is going to stay there.
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, there is a part in the statute that talks about complaint proceedings being confidential. And whenever we send anything out, we have a cover page that's put on there saying that, you know, this is not to be shared with anyone, it's confidential by law and so forth. That's a very good question. There is not a paper that is signed by either legislators or public members on the committee that states that the information that they receive or that they're privy to is confidential. There are certain things that are confidential by statute, and within our rules of procedure, other information within the Ethics Committee is confidential. When I hired my temporary staff person, I did have her sign a confidentiality agreement and pointed out several confidentiality agreements, statutes within the Ethics Code. I also checked with the Ombudsman's Office, who requires each one of their staff to sign a confidentiality agreement, and got a copy of that so I would see exactly what they had. So it's a good point, and I know when new people come on the committee, I do point out to them that there are, you know, the information is confidential, but they do not sign anything, and maybe that's something the Ethics Committee should do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe we should just think about that.
Okay. I'm going to offer Amendment Number 3 in a moment, but before I do, my preamble is going to be that it's been an interesting year for all elected officials, even through and as of yesterday, and yesterday's news, and the headlines in the paper today, and all the way through to my lunch at Olivia's today when we were trying to divvy up the lunch bill. And I'm going to direct members to the statute page that Jane gave you. This is section 24.45.051, subsection B1. And B1 is cost $15 or less for a meal. And I'm going to offer an amendment, and then I'm very open to an amendment to the amendment to reconsider an amount that would be acceptable to this committee, because I think it was, as often is the case, an overreaction to a hot environment, and it's been an interesting year. It's been a good experiment, and lessons are learned, but it's made life complicated, and I don't think it's had a great effect on policy and policymakers, other than to make it rather awkward when a bill comes for dinner. And so with that preamble and the chair's amenable environment to an amendment to the amendment, I'm going to offer Amendment Number 3, Susan, to section 24.45.051, section B, subsection B, number 1, which is cost $15 or less, and I'm going to move that we change the increment of $15 to $35. Yes, and that's amendment number 3. Would somebody object?
I'll object so that we can talk about it.
Representative Coghill objects for the...
Where are we at on this? This is for you, just to speak.
And Mr. Chairman, sorry, what did we exactly... I was... helping Susan find the section to change it to 35, was that the
mm-hmm. Okay. So we have before us Amendment Number 3, and Amendment Number 3 would change the cost of a meal going out to $35, which is about a dinner and a soft drink, or a dinner and a glass of wine. And it's not $50, it's not Silver Oak at dinner, it's not the old days. I don't want to call them the good old days because they, clearly they were not. And so that's the amendment. That's amendment number three. Representative Coghill objected. It would move the meal allowance to $35 before it's reportable. Representative Coghill has objected. There's committee discussion. Representative Grunberg.
I wouldn't object if you wanted to go up to 50.
Ooh, I would.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a policy call.
That's fine.
So is there other discussion on the amendment? Representative Coghill?
Actually, that was the first thing that I thought of, is what is unethical? That's the question we're trying to decide. We're talking about regulations of lobbying, and when is it unethical for them to talk to you? Is $50 lunch or dinner unethical? Is $35 unethical? $15 makes the ethical question narrowed down so far that it becomes almost contemptible. Because what you're going to do is that at that point you should say they can never do it except they report it. And what you're saying here is under the reporting requirements, if it's exorbitant, then you want to make sure that people know that very well. It seems to me that's the discussion. And so at that point, $50 in some places could be exorbitant. And so that's probably hitting right up there where you have you could be a little more lavish at lunch, but at dinner it's not exorbitant. And so that's the interesting question, isn't it? So when does a lobbyist generally want to have access to you? It's generally not at lunchtime. And so the question is $50 ethically exorbitant or not? I don't think it is, personally. I don't mind if they report it either, quite frankly. But it becomes kind of an interesting question on the access question then. Should other people come and talk to you from your district and take you out to dinner? And it costs them $35 or $50 to sit down at a meal with you. Should they be under the tension? Because that's what's created by the $35 or the $15. It's created a tension on, is this really ethical? And really, it's not even an ethical question. It's just a reporting question. But the problem has, we've made it an ethical question. And so I'm personally willing to say $50 is not unethically exorbitant. So I tend to agree. $35 is probably more reasonable in a lunch. In fact, if we go to NCSL, CSG, and places like that, and we have been invited out to a bunch of dinners, and what happens is just the fact that we're there together, there's this cloud of ethical question just hangs over it, and it's really not an ethical problem. It's a chance for us to get together and talk about the business of the day. It is true, though, that they have an access to you that nobody else has. And so I don't mind them reporting it. That way, if we say at $35 a plate or whatever, $35, what is it, unless the food and beverage is $35, to me that's kind of the place where it's probably more close to reasonable, and $50 is not unreasonable. Right. And so in my mind, so I could probably stay with $35 because I think that gives everybody the breathing room to say it's not an ethical problem. And then beyond that, hey, we should report it. We have access. It's beginning to be expensive at that point. But I tell you what, I took my kids out to dinner the other day. And
to where?
And I wasn't by in favor, but it sure looked like it by the end of time I paid the bill. So, and there was nothing unethical about that. But so I would say $35 is the bottom, $50 is the top in my mind. So $35 is okay with me, but $50 is not exorbitant in my mind.
The difficulty for me, just one moment, Representative. The difficulty for me is I just had lunch at Olivia's. I'm a bean burrito and a beef taco guy. I think it's A at Olivia's lunch, and it's a $9 lunch. And having lunch with Kevin Jardell, and he said, I'm having the shrimp fajitas. I've never had. I'm not that great of a shrimp eater. I thought, I would like to try that. And because I ordered it without looking at the menu, when the bill came in, it was $18.95. I had $18.95 and the drink, and I have to put it together, and then you come up with $5, and you're like, all right, is that enough money? And then your ethics begins to get tested over the $2 or the $3 that takes you outside of the 15, rather than it certainly trumps the policy conversation at the table, which happened to be about the legislative skits anyway, and my desire to leave town before they transpire. So we certainly weren't talking oil and gas, but self-protection mechanisms.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have that problem. My lobbyist friends take me to Costco. For dollar and a half.
You're okay. So that being said, Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, one other thing, too, is that I think that many times lobbyists would do it at dinner. And for those of us who are married, that often does include our spouses. And, you know, that's just nothing. And, you know, they would do that as a matter of courtesy. And so I would.
Well, I'm open to an amendment to 35, 40, 45, 50. I think above 50, I'm with Representative Coghill. It goes too far. Representative Gatto.
Question. Does that include the tip?
No.
No.
Or tax.
I can't read it in here that it doesn't.
Right. No. I believe that's been an excuse, Mr. Chair. That's a yes. Judgment call that's been made by APOC that it does not include.
Okay, so we have before us amendment number 3. Does any member wish to offer an amendment to the amendment? Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to offer an amendment to amendment number 3, and that would be to change the dollar amount to $50.
Okay. So we have amendment to amendment number 3 before us. Is there an objection? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
I do have a question on this subject.
So we're back to amendment number 3. The amount has now by amendment been changed to $50. Representative Coghill has objected. Do you have a comment, Representative Grunberg?
Well, let me just make my comment. I don't know if you're maintaining your objection or not.
So far.
But Representative Gatto, as is often the case, has raised, I think, an important issue. When a person looks at the bill, they don't necessarily look at the tip, because they add the tip on. But the tax is kind of included in there. Do we want to say anything? No, okay, fine.
Representative Coghill, do you want to maintain the objection for the purposes of?
Well, I've already described what my comfort level is. I'd say at 35, the reporting issue still gets you into the ethical dilemma, I think, of reporting. And if we're going to say that reporting, and this is kind of the interesting dynamic, it's all of a sudden come to where reporting is an ethical question. And that's the dilemma. So either we should say no, or we should leave enough room in there where there's no question about the legitimacy of a more realistic look at what it costs. You know, lunch, I understand that. It could be, but dinner, not. So that's my dilemma. However, just knowing the process in this legislature, this is not the last place the eyes will see this.
I agree.
And so I would start there, and we'll start the discussion.
And for,
so I'll
and
remove my objection.
Start for 50?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the objection has been removed. Do you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy that the.
So if the objection has been removed, then amendment number 3 passes from committee.
Correct.
Okay, amendment number 3 passes from committee. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you. All I wanted to put on the record is, as we all, I think right now, we tend to think about what the cost of meals are in Juneau, but as we travel around to the state, to rural areas, and you're paying for the cost of food to be transported, if we're at different, you know, CSG or NCSL meetings in, you know, very big cities, I mean, sometimes you can't get an appetizer for $50. And I really think most of us are really quite reasonable in our food choices. I mean, I know I really very seldom even go out to dinner with lobbyists, but when I do, I can pretty much say with a surety I never order what I really want.
Representative Dahlstrom, it really begs the follow-up question. Representative Cotto.
Thank you, Joyce. Joyce, just for the record, just stop me when I'm wrong. Does not include tax, does not include tip, does not include room rental, because it got stung one time. They said, your portion of this is $125 because the room rental, the liquor, the meal, the dessert, and they went on and on. They said, that's what it costs. And I said, well, that's a lot of money. I wouldn't have gone. So I paid it. But if it was $50 and the room rental and the other things were, I could deduct from that as far as what the meal was, and that then they could easily buy me the meal. But they're also buying a room.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I'm a little confused about what you're talking about, because normally you would go out to dinner and it would either be at a restaurant or whatever. So if you could explain a little bit so I can comment.
They take eight people out to a restaurant and then they rent a room that is reserved for the eight people and the five lobbyists, whatever. And then the bill comes, and when you divide the bill up, it's pretty darn high. And so should they be reporting? I mean, the bill was so high, I said, I don't want you paying for it.
Representative Goddard, with all due respect to somebody who has some expertise in this area, room rents, I don't think you're subject to, a room rental rate. If I was a pharmacy guy, and I rented the room at Pike's Hotel, and I was also a registered lobbyist, and it was a $50 meal, and it came with a $150 room rental in order to host the meal in that room, as some hotels or restaurants have migrated to, the charge for you is relative to the food only.
I just want to be clear. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions as it relates to House Bill 193? Joyce, do you have other issues? And Representative Gruenberg, do you have another issue?
You want a couple of amendments.
Okay. Joyce, are we moving along in a direction that's satisfactory to you? Are you pleased?
Want to keep you happy.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Reneva?
Mr. Chairman, before we get too far away from the confidentiality issue, Jane has passed out the statute for the Citizens Review Panel and the confidentiality section of their statutes. You may want to adopt a conceptual amendment that applies this to the members of the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics.
And this is section 235.23547.14.235.
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment, I think that would be a very good idea.
Okay, yes, please. And Reneva, could you format the amendment, the conceptual amendment for us, please?
Meeting of the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics for a member or staff of, I'm not sure you have to repeat it again, but of the committee may not make any disclosure related to information obtained during a review by the committee.
Were you able to pick that up on the microphone? The microphone's in front of Joyce. Okay, I'd like. Okay, you were able to get it. So I would like to offer this as a conceptual amendment number 4.
I'll object.
Okay, Representative Holmes objects. And can you state that one more time, please, Reneva?
A person attending confidentiality. A person attending a meeting of the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics or a member or staff of the committee may not make any disclosures related to information obtained during a review by the committee, or you may want to say proceeding of the committee.
Okay. Representative Holmes has objected. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My concern under that is that there are parts of those committee hearings that are public and parts that are confidential, and I don't want to accidentally make everything that transpires in an open public meeting subject to a confidentiality, so I want to be careful. I'm not sure that we just cast the net over everything that transpires during public meetings.
If it's
logical.
Those two. And I'm going to do number two.
Yeah, but that's the amendment says anything that happens during a meeting.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, we need to change it to a proceeding. The word proceeding used in the ethics statute specifically refers to a complaint. So if we wanted to use the word proceeding, we could say proceeding. And then the only other one that is confidential by statute is an advisory opinion that's requested under a confidential basis. So we could say, you know, a proceeding or an advisory opinion under and list the statute number, okay. Which I think is 2460-158.
Okay. What's your preference, Representative Holmes?
I think I'd be more comfortable with that. I think because there will be other eyes looking at this, there may be time for us to go back and catch if we don't.
So what's your preference? Would you like me to withdraw conceptual amendment number four, and you would like to make conceptual amendment number five, or do you want to amend conceptual amendment number four?
We can go ahead and amend your conceptual amendment if that's okay.
Okay, so there.
I can move a conceptual amendment number one to conceptual amendment number four.
Okay, so we have an amendment. We have an amendment to conceptual amendment number four. Please offer that.
Mr. Chairman, could we have Rainier or Joyce do that for me?
Joyce, would you offer that, please?
I will try, Mr. Chair. I'm working on it. A person attending a meeting of the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics or a member or staff of the committee may not make any disclosure related to a proceeding, and we could say under 2460-170, or an advisory opinion request under AS 2460-160 unless authorized. We don't need that. I'm sorry. And just close it with 160. I'll read that again. Person attending a meeting of the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics or a member or staff of the committee may not make any disclosure related to a proceeding under AS 2460-170 or an advisory opinion request under AS 2460-160.
Thank you. Representative Gatto objects.
Procedural. Are we supposed to be in Title 47 here?
No, this is just language.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, we are taking language from the Citizens Review Panel confidentiality statute, and we're applying it to the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics.
Okay, so what statute are we amending?
Through the chair, we are adding a new subsection of Title 24.
It's 2:35. I've got a lot more work I want to get through today, so I want us to get focused on what we're doing. Representative Gatto, you objected to the amendment to the conceptual amendment.
I did, Mr. Chair, because it seems like this is a forever clause. While it may be that this information becomes public, and yet even though it's public, the way it's written, you would be forever denied the opportunity to discuss it. So I.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gatto, I don't look at it that way because under those two particular sections, there are certain parts that do become public under that process. And so the complaint decision is made process, which means that I, as the administrator and the members on the Ethics Committee, can talk about that. With the advisory opinion, even though you requested under a confidentiality reason, it does become public and it's redacted, so it is public. So I think we're covering those concerns you have.
Okay, the objection is removed. Conceptual amendment to conceptual amendment number four passes. Is the objection maintained for conceptual amendment number four?
I remove my objection.
The objection is removed. Conceptual amendment number four passes from committee. Representative Gruenberg, you wish to offer T.2 as amendment number five?
I think this is amendment number six, isn't it, Susan?
Amendment number five.
Number five, okay, yes.
So we have before us T.2 as amendment number five. Is there an objection?
I'll object so that we can.
Representative Coghill objects for the purposes of discussion. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you will look, if you look at the last two pages of the bill, starting page 10, line 31, the term private benefit was misdrafted inadvertently. It's unintelligible, and Dan Wayne just cleaned it up.
All right, so is the objection maintained?
I just thought it would be good to send to the Ethics Committee things that are not intelligible.
It's lucky it's not the Select Committee on Intelligence.
No, I would leave with my objection.
All right, so objection to amendment number five is removed. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one more amendment. It's T1. I'd like it to be labeled Amendment Number 6.
Amendment Number 6. Is there an objection to Amendment Number 6?
I'll object.
Representative Coghill objects for the purpose of discussion.
Tell me about it.
Thank you very much. This is an amendment that will allow a person who is a licensed professional in the state of Alaska to represent another person for compensation in a hearing, subject to the ethics rule in 2460-100. And this language was originally basically in language that was suggested by the Chief Judge, Terry Thurbin, and then was excised in a subcommittee in state affairs. It's extremely important, in my opinion, that people be able to get counsel if they need them in these situations, and definitely will protect the clients. And these people are subject to rules of professional conduct and can be either disciplined or disbarred if they're abused there.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill.
Reneva Moss sat in the subcommittee through the whole process, and there's two sides to this question, and I thought at least have her tell us what the discussion was. And I tend to agree with the maker of the amendment, but I thought at least we should have the discussion on the table, and there might even be room for amendment.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, and I would point out that the administrative judge was neutral on this issue. The concern of Representative Seaton was that any legislator who represented someone before an administrative hearing officer would have a certain amount of influence just by the fact that they are a legislator, and he had concerns about that influence. However, I think Representative Gruenberg has said the other side. There are legislators who, for a living, and I can think of one in the past that actually did represent their clients before administrative hearing officers. That was their line of legal expertise. So without this amendment, that particular legislator would no longer be allowed to represent his clients in front of an administrative judge.
Representative Cogger?
And to me, the policy question is, are we citizens first and then legislators, or are we legislators and never can be citizens? And I fall on the side is that we're citizens first, and then we have reporting responsibilities, but we still should be able to carry out our professions. And so I tend to agree with the maker of the amendment, but I just wanted that discussion to be before us.
Okay, is the objection maintained? Objection is removed. Amendment Number 6 passes from committee. Are there other amendments? Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the CS for House Bill Number 193, Version T, with any attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Seeing no objection, House Bill 193 moves from committee. If we can move to HJR 13, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Reneva. Joyce, wonderful to see you. Thank you very much. We appreciate all your help and your hard work in a minefield. And a mine, and sometimes a minefield and sometimes a mine shaft, depending on the day and the issue.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Chair, my staff is on the way in. Could we take the other amendment first? No. Okay.
The other bill first. I think we're going to spend a little bit of time on HJR.
Okay.
Two, is it Carl, Representative Gatto, is it a
personal pronoun?
Okay. My staff has arrived now, so she'll present number 13 if you're
on 2 or 13. 13.
Yes, for 13.
HJR 13.
HJR 13.
Okay.
Hi, Deneen. It's a pleasure to have you before the committee. If you'll introduce yourself for the record and give us the story.
My name is Deneen Tuck. I am Administrative Assistant, Chief of Staff for Representative Gruenberg. Okay. And right before you is the House Joint Resolution 13, constitutional amendment proposing to change within the Constitution two spots that still stay Secretary of State versus the Lieutenant Governor, which back in 1970, the Alaskan voters had voted to remove Secretary of State from the Constitution and put in Lieutenant Governor. There were the two areas that were missed. Of course, back then in the 70s, we didn't have a computer to search and find, so two areas were missed, and they still refer to Secretary of State in the Constitution.
Well done. Are there questions? Representative Coghill.
Have there been conversations with the Lieutenant Governor?
We believe there have. Mr. Chair, I believe there have been. I can't swear, but I'm quite sure.
First year, I believe we spoke with them, yes.
Mr. Chairman, I'm entertaining a statute that would empower a Secretary of State.
Really? Really?
The Lieutenant Governor might not be as strong as we think.
Particularly in the area of foreign affairs.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dahlstrom.
So, Mr. Chair, with that being potentially on the table, we still need to clean this up.
Because the Secretary of State and Lieutenant Governor would have different responsibilities.
Okay. Sure. Well, maybe that wouldn't be such a good idea, but we could have at least an authority to start the discussion. I'm sorry. I just said earlier before the committee I didn't have a sense of humor.
I'm not sure how to handle your levity, Representative Coghill. You're throwing me today.
Mr. Chair, I thought he was going to talk about being in charge of the state seal, and then we'd have to refer to the Alaska Zoo.
Which brings us back to H3.
Chairman, I've actually voted for this before. So.
Yeah.
All right. So are there any questions about HJR 13? Deneen, excellent job. You did a fine job. Thank you very much for presenting. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move House Joint Resolution number 13, version A, with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations from committee.
Thank you. With that, HJR 13 passes from committee. If we can go now to HJR 2, Representative Fugato.
You want to sit up there, and I'll sit here.
You're welcome to sit. We're ready. Yep.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is the 50th anniversary of statehood, and a couple of comments. I looked in the Constitution itself for how many times it's been amended, and I come up with, since 1966 to 2004, 14 times we have changed the Constitution. I'm not sure how significant the amendments were, but it is an awful lot of times. Number two is... Article 1, Section 3, no person is to be denied the enjoyment of any civil or political right because of race, color, creed, sex, or national origin. And so I'm addressing the issue of sex in here. And want to point out to 15, under veto, the governor may veto bills passed by the legislature. Then it says he may, by veto, strike or reduce items in appropriation bills. He shall return any vetoed bill with the statement of his objections to the House of Origin. This goes on in many places, and even more importantly, qualifications of the governor. Governor shall be at least 30 years of age and qualified voter of the state. He shall have been a resident of Alaska at least 7 years, and he shall have been a citizen of the U.S. for 7. I can go through here. There are quite a few times, even with regard to military authority, where he may call out these forces to execute the laws. He shall appoint the commission of other officers, etc. And so what I've asked is that we can go through here and substitute changes, recognizing that 6 of the 54 signers of the original Constitution were women. Currently we have 9 representatives, 3 senators that are women here. We have a female governor, 12 female legislators, several female commissioners, female judges, not to mention the Chief Justice Dana Fabe, and on and on and on. What this will do is substitute he, him, and himself, and use the appropriate pronoun. That's the entire bill.
Thank you. Representative Lynn? Would the sponsor explain the difference between gender and sex? Does gender have to do with language, or what? Difference between gender and sex.
Well, sometimes it refers can't discriminate on the basis of sex.
And you discriminate under through the chair under gender.
Discriminating under the basis of.
Representative Gatto.
I, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I thought you were going to say everyone has a gender, but not everyone has sex.
Oh my.
The red light is
on. I don't care what you
call it. Representative Gatto, Representative Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what you call it, as long as I have it.
Representative Lynn.
What is
Representative Lynn.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, you agree with me then.
I almost always do, Representative Lynn. Are there questions?
No, seriously, is there a difference between gender and sex in law or in common practice or what? I've always wondered that. Serious question.
Representative Gatto?
Federal law says you may not discriminate on the basis of sex. It doesn't say on the basis of gender, but I believe it refers to both. Meaning that it was referring to gender when it used the word sex.
And so in the context, Mr. Chair, sex would be more appropriate or gender would be more appropriate? Does it make any difference?
Gender is more appropriate.
I'm going to defer to the prime sponsor of the bill. Representative Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to point out that Article 3, Section 17 of the Constitution currently says, convening legislature. Whenever the governor considers it in the public interest, he may convene the legislature, either House or the two houses in joint session. Mr. Chairman, I think if we were not to pass this, that we couldn't be called into special session for the remainder of this governor's term, and we might want to rethink this bill.
Okay, point made.
This won't happen for a while.
Are there other questions for the bill sponsor? Are there any amendments to the bill? Satisfactory to the members? All right, with that, Representative Holmes, Chair would entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move HJR 2, version R, with any attached fiscal note and individual recommendations from committee.
Seeing no objection, HJR 2 moves from committee. It is 10 minutes of 3. Jane, what are we going to do on Monday, and what time do we meet on Monday?
We have an 8 a.m. meeting. We will be doing HB 36, HB 9 in the
afternoon. Okay. All right. So Monday we will convene in the morning at 8 o'clock. HB 9 is the death penalty bill. We will only.
Kelly too.
Pardon me.
HB 186, machine gun Kelly.
Okay. And HB 186, and we will only take up HB 9 if all members are present, so that members may offer amendments and participate in discussion. But I will ask the members when we do take up HB 9. That we try to limit discussion because we have contributed so much time to this issue and that we make our points and then move on through amendments rather than to talk an issue to death that people feel strongly about. But we certainly know the future of that bill is not bright. So with that, at 10 minutes to 3, we're adjourned for today.
We talk it to death. We don't have a vote.